Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, I'm Veronica Scarsbrick. Welcome to the broadcast. I'll be with you for the next half hour, and in a few moments I'll be putting the encyclical of Pope Paul VI, Populorum Progressio, into historical context, taking a look at how religious organizations can flex their financial muscles to promote ethical business. But first, Pope Benedict XVI's words at his customary weekly general audience with pilgrims from across the world. Lydia O'Kane reports, bringing us Pope Benedict's special appeal this Wednesday. Let's listen.
Giungono dolorose notizie circa la precaria situazione umanitaria della Somalia.
Pope Benedict spoke on Wednesday of the grievous humanitarian situation facing the people of Somalia, especially in Mogadishu, and called for those with political responsibility, both at a local and international level, to find a peaceful solution to the ongoing conflict. The Pope made the appeal at the end of his weekly general audience, adding that he had been following the evolving events in the country with trepidation and encouraged aid workers who had remained in the region to continue their efforts to provide relief to those in need. The United Nations says the number of Somalis uprooted by fighting in their own country has hit a staggering 1 million, with nearly 200,000 streaming out of the capital in the past 2 weeks alone. Up to 600,000 people were thought to have fled Mogadishu since February, when clashes pitting allied Somali-Ethiopian troops against suspected insurgents started escalating. The number of displaced this year are in addition to the 400,000 that fled their homes because of the previous fighting in the nation of 10 million people. Bishop Giorgio Bertin, who is Apostolic Administrator for Mogadishu, says this appeal will do much to raise awareness of the serious humanitarian situation in the country.
I am very grateful for the appeal the Pope has made, let us say, on behalf of the Church, and particularly on behalf of the Church in Somalia, what remains of the Church in Somalia. And I am sure that this appeal will have the effect of keeping alive the attention of a terrible humanitarian crisis which is still unfolding in Somalia and which for the time being finds no solution.
During his audience in St. Peter's Square, the assembled faithful listened intently as the Holy Father, dressed in a red cloak to ward off the winter chill, also continued his catechesis on the founding fathers of the early church. This week, Pope Benedict focused on the figure of St. Ephrates.
We turn to Ephrates, an outstanding figure of 4th century Syria Christianity. The Syriac church, Semitic in her language and thought, remained close to the Jewish Christian tradition and were deeply influenced by native forms of asceticism and monasticism. Ephrates was thus part of an ecclesial community on the frontier between Judaism and the Greek world.
The Holy Father went on to talk about the many works based on Christ the saint had written.
He has left us 23 talks, known as demonstrations, on various aspects of the Christian life. His style is vivid and close to that of the Bible. In the Syriac tradition, he presents Christ as a physician who heals us from the wounds of sin and our great teacher of prayer.
Towards the end of his audience, Pope Benedict drew large cheers from the crowd when he addressed them in English.
To all the English-speaking pilgrims and visitors, I extend a warm welcome. May our visit to Rome be a time of growth and renewal.
Finally, the Holy Father gave his apostolic blessing, saying, "Upon all of you, I cordially invoke an abundance of joy and peace in our Lord Jesus Christ." I'm Lydia O'Kane.
My thanks there to Lydia O'Kane for bringing us the Pope's words at his weekly general audience with pilgrims from across the world. Meanwhile, here in the Vatican, the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace, opened a two-day plenary assembly on Monday, celebrating the 40th anniversary of Pope Paul VI's social encyclical Populorum Progressio. By looking at the theme of human development, today's problems and perspectives, Philippa Hitchin reports.
Council President Cardinal Renato Raffaele Martino addressed the opening session, tracing the legacy of Pope Paul VI's groundbreaking encyclical, calling for the progressive development of all peoples. He noted how its appeal to men and women of goodwill to help resolve the scourges of poverty and famine has lost none of its resonance in our modern globalized society. The Cardinal commented that today there is still an urgent need for the international community to mobilize itself to promote sustainable and just development for all. Cardinal Martino also emphasized that it is the duty of the Pontifical Council, born in 1967, the same year as Populorum Progressio was written, to promote the document's teachings on humanism and its call to action. In the course of the two-day seminar, a document evaluating the Council's progress in this area is being presented and discussed by delegates. On Wednesday, Honduran Cardinal Oscar Rodriguez Maradiaga will lead a discussion on the social teaching on human development from Populorum Progressio to today. And there will also be a presentation of the cause of beatification for Vietnamese Cardinal François Xavier Nguyen Van Thuan, former president of the Vatican Council, who died in 2002. On Friday, the plenary assembly will make way for the second World Congress of the Ecclesial Organizations Working for Justice and Peace, which draws together over 300 participants from all five continents to discuss the theme, the development of the whole man and of all men. I'm Philippa Hitchin.
My thanks there to Philippa Hitchin for bringing us this report. And now, after looking briefly there at Pope Paul VI's encyclical Populorum Progressio in the context of today, I'd like to step back in time in an effort to offer you a more in-depth look at the historical context in which it was drawn up. I do that with a professor of church social teaching at a pontifical university, that of St. Thomas here in Rome. The professor, well, he's Dominican, Father Alejandro Crosthwaite.
Well, by the time of Paul VI in the 1960s, of course, the world again is in transformation. We're having a whole new way of looking at the world, as way as the, also we have the Vietnam War, so we have a lot of issues going on in with regards to peace and war. But it's a whole different society. Vatican II has already taken place, which already opened the church. So the church is also a very different church from the one we had during John the 23rd. And so everything is in movement, everything is in transition. And I think in society especially, people are open to new possibilities. They're kind of discovering and researching, experimenting with different things, and personally as well as in society. Vatican II was very optimistic. Gaudium Spes, that basically calls the church to be servant in the world, to be attentive to the needs of the human person. And the principle that comes out of Gaudium Spes from 1965 is the whole question of human dignity. So that principle becomes canonized, let's say, at Gaudium Spes, where it sees the individual. And so we begin to talk about the subject, that the individual is a subject with the capability of transforming his world. So that's why I think Paul VI names this encyclical Populorum Progressio, the progress of the peoples. So that peoples themselves, us again, we are having a lot of countries finding independence and trying to kind of discover what it means to be a nation and a democracy or whatever system they're trying to try. People are trying to find new ways of being. So he's discovering that. And so he talks about progress and he talks about development. As countries are developing and so on, he has a special concern with the principle of solidarity with people. And so that becomes a new term. It won't be defined until John Paul II, but we already have the principle of solidarity, That means that we are not only aware and concerned of the problems of other people, but we're going to do something about it. So we are in solidarity with them. This becomes a principle that we are supposed to work together in developing the progress of people. And he also begins to use a new term that already develops in Latin America, but is kind of new for Catholic social teaching, and that's the term liberation. So we have the beginnings of liberation theology in Latin America, and this begins to also influence Paul VI. So we hear about the liberation of people, and we hear a little bit about the call to integral liberation. So when he talks about development, the way it was seen at that time, especially in the secular world, was financial development. As long as we financially develop the different countries, we'll end poverty, we will end social problems that we're encountering. Paul VI reminds us the human person, based on Vatican II, the dignity of the human person, is more than just the material. It's also spiritual. So it has to be an integral, holistic development. And so that's why it's Populorum Progressio. But he also begins to talk about liberation. Liberation from those situations that somehow do not allow the human person to be all that they're called to be, to fulfill their human dignity. So we have Paul VI talking about this question of liberation, and which is already being spoken about in Latin American circles with theologians. The Conference of Medellin, which happens in 1968, so 1 year later, is already the beginnings of liberation theology. So this begins to also influence a little bit the thought of Paul VI. So we could say this is a new development also. So the call to a holistic progress, an integral progress of the peoples, but also the question about liberating from certain structures that somehow do not allow the dignity of the human person to be to its fullness.
Listening to you, it seems to me that we talk about Paul VI as being a modern pope, and yet we've moved on from those ideas, haven't we?
Well, we have moved in one sense. There's still a big discussion among theologians, for example, what are we called to do, develop nations, or the question of development. Or are we called more to liberation, for example, which would be the big issue for liberation theology? So those are things that are still being discussed. I think development has been misunderstood many times to just simply mean development, progress, and progress by itself will bring a better society. But Paul VI, in one sense, continues to remind us it is the human person that is at the center of everything and the human dignity. So progress for progress' sake, without considering the dignity of the human person, is not development at all. So in that sense, his principles are very much valuable, even today.
Paul VI also has another considered minor document.
Yes, it's Octogesim Adveniens. And basically, one of the titles is Call to Action. And for me, actually, it's a very special document. It's a pastoral letter. It's not an encyclical. And for the first time in any writing of a pope, we see a pope saying, I don't know everything. So it's up to the local communities to take the principles of Catholic social teaching, see their reality, and see how those principles apply to their particular situation. So at the introduction of that document, he basically talks about that. And what I've been kind of mentioning throughout the conversation, that it's the seeing the worker or the common person as a subject. We see it very clearly in Octogesim Adveniens. So for me, that's where it starts, really, where he sees the church has principles to teach and principles to continue on, but we cannot give an answer to the whole problem. We're simply not capable, because every single country, every single community is different. And he acknowledges that. And that's the first time we ever hear that. And so he calls upon the local communities, grassroots movements, to start thinking about Catholic social teaching, about the scriptures, and how does that apply to their particular situation. In one sense, one could say that Paul VI is taking, again, liberation theology's method of doing theology, which is to see, to judge, and then to act. So it's a way of doing theology in liberation theology. So he says, yeah, look at your particular situation. These are the principles, and how are you to act in your particular countries? So also we begin to see a lot of documents coming out from local conference of bishops addressing the social problems of their own country. Not that they had not been before this time, but we see more during this time, precisely because Paul VI is saying, this is what you're supposed to do. So I think it's a revolutionary document, actually. And this begins to change the perception of the church. The ecclesiology begins to change that was called by Vatican II. Because the next big meeting is the Justitia in Mundo, which is the Bishop Synod, dealing with the issue of justice. So it's no longer the Holy Father, it's now the bishops of the world. So this call of a new change of ecclesiology and the awareness that every local community is different with different problems and that we cannot give an answer for all. It's a new development, I think, it's against encyclical.
Our thanks there go to Professor of Church Social Teaching at the Pontifical University of St. Thomas here in Rome, Dominican Father Alejandro Crosswaite, who gave us a bird's eye view of the historical context in which Pope Paul VI drew up his encyclical Populorum Progressio. And now let's change the subject by putting our money where our faith is. Members of the International Interfaith Investment Group, in fact, attended by representatives of nearly 24 Christian, Jewish, and Buddhist faith organizations, have urged the world's major faiths to use their financial clout to promote ethical business. Religious lobby groups say the world's major faiths wield enormous economic power in stocks and shares and therefore have the real potential to transform the global money markets. However, they believe that until now, faith organizations have consistently failed to use their financial clout to the full when it comes to putting pressure on companies to adopt more ethical policies. So how can churches and faith organizations flex their full financial muscle and convince businesses to mend their ways? Father Seamus Finn, who's an oblate of Mary Immaculate and also a board member of the International Interfaith Investment Group, spoke to Susie Hodges about the growing popularity of ethical investing and the opportunities it offers for the Catholic Church and other faith-based organizations.
I think it's made some unbelievable progress in the last 10 years. This is a concept we well know that has been around for a long time, at least here in the United States. Where I think the big change has taken place is probably from the mid-90s to the present, where access to information, communication of information, verification of information about the activities of banks, of corporations, across the board, and across national boundaries has become much more accessible so that the conscious, committed, socially responsible, or faith investor really has access to a lot more information. And they're not throwing a dart, as it were, in the dark and trying to come up with the best company or the most positive one or the one that least violates human rights or damages the environment. So it's grown exponentially in the last 10 years. And I think from the financial side, for a community that's very reticent to let any kind of social or environmental criteria enter into their decision making, I think we've made some ground there as well in the sense that corporations are now becoming much more sensitive to such things as damage to their reputation, damage to their image, long-term risk, a long-term liability for something that might have taken place 20, 30, 40 years ago, particularly in the area of the environment or human rights. So I think there's a combination of different things that have put in place that have put ethical investing and faith-consistent investing on a much firmer footing in recent years.
But when it comes to figures, what percentage do they form when it comes to the overall picture of investments or businesses?
In terms of invested funds, for instance, in equity markets in the United States, we're talking in the range of about 10 or 11%. Given the size and the way the economy has been growing and the equity markets have been growing, that's fairly big. It may be a little less in Europe, but it's growing in both arenas. And I think the more that the message is spread and the more that the investor becomes aware of what and how they can do this and the allies that they may have out there who share their same either values or their beliefs, I think we're only going to see that grow.
Is it true, though, that up until now, faith investors, including the Catholic Church, have failed to use their investment clout to the full, i.e. they focus solely on what not to invest in, as you say, like weapons or pornography, abortion providers, etc.?
Well, I think it's really a three-step process in that regard. I think we would strongly, for instance, for the investor who may just be skeptical or nervous and want to take a first step, we would encourage them to vote their proxy or engage in the opportunities that are presented by the companies that they invest in, whether it's an annual meeting process or a dialogue process or an engagement process. For those who may be, you know, wanting to get to stage two, then they may want to, you know, propose, you know, that they are going to exclude some companies from their portfolio, or they may include a company because they want to try and help the company improve. So they may file stockholder resolutions for consideration by all the shareholders at the annual meeting. I think step three is the one that you referred to, and I think we're beginning to see some very positive developments in those areas, which is to try and move away altogether from the sectors in the industry or the corporations that we don't want to invest in, whether it's nuclear arms or military or a variety of other issues, and to actually put money into what we would call a via positiva. In other words, looking for investment opportunities that we think are going to make a positive contribution to local communities wherever they're operating or to the global community. So an example of some of those would be sustainable transportation in the healthcare area, particularly with aging populations in Europe and the United States, and obviously on the environmental side, the cleaner energy areas.
You mentioned earlier that companies nowadays are much more image conscious and they don't want to get a bad press. So do you feel that this is evidence that this, shall we say, more active clout that's been wielded by faith-based investors and the shareholder resolutions that they're tabling are beginning to, you know, have an effect?
I think clearly it is, and I think it's a combination of the faith-based investor, the socially responsible investor, which includes quite a number of mutual funds, quite a number of pension funds, public pension funds and private pension funds, and I think for a number of industries, the consumer, the informed consumer, whether it's a person of faith or a person who's simply concerned about being consistent in the choices that they make in their lives and for the future, that has a huge impact. If it's a company that is selling clothing, people do want to know where was the clothing made and how are the workers paid and what was the impact on the environment, on any of the dyes that might have been used in the textile, if it's textile. Same thing we've seen recently, certainly in the last 6 months, the numbers of millions of toys that have been recalled by some of the leading toy makers in the world. We know that fully 85% of toys are manufactured in China today, and question about kind of the paint has been highlighted recently. So the consumer is asking, you know, are these toys safe for my children? Are they safe for my grandchildren? So I think it's a combination of the investor, faith-based investor, the socially responsible investor, the consumer, that all together with specific companies has pushed them to being much more aware, I think. And more recently, we're beginning to see, for instance, the whole question of the carbon footprint and climate change. So that, you know, we're beginning to ask these products, how far are they traveling and what's the impact on the environment of bringing footwear or apparel or toys from China to the United States or China to Europe, and what's the impact in terms of global warming and climate change that happens because of those kinds of supply chain issues.
So companies are becoming more aware, but can you give me some concrete examples of where companies have actually changed or modified their policies because of lobbying by faith-based investors?
I think a very specific conversation that we had and we engaged in with Nike, for instance, back 10, 12 years ago, some concerns that were exposed about their factories and where their footwear was being made. I think they made a commitment at that time to put on their website the location of all their factories around the world. I think that was a positive step. It doesn't answer all the questions, but I think it provides an increased level of access to information that we think was extremely positive. I think somebody like The Gap, which is a clothing apparel company, made some similar kinds of commitments. I think we've had some very good conversations with a company like Walmart, for instance, about the packaging of their materials, asking them to be much more attentive to the amount of packaging that they use on items that are sold in their stores, and then the content. What is the packaging, and how is any kinds of plastics and things of that sort, how are they being disposed of? And they've been responsive. We would like them still to do other things, and we're working on them. We're making those suggestions to them on a regular basis. But we've been pleased with some of the changes that we've seen so far.
And when it comes to the Catholic Church, what additional specific action would you like to see the Church taking to promote faith-based or ethical investment services and policies?
I would really like to see a much more pronounced and explicit commitment by the institutions in the Church to faith-consistent investing. It has been heavily at the moment into what I would describe as a via negativa. In other words, just simply looking at areas or sectors to avoid, and worked pretty much within that framework. I think the Church is, as a global institution, even though it's broken down into obviously many different dioceses and archdioceses and institutions, educational institutions and hospitals and the like, I think it can play a very positive role here if it sees its mission as also being inclusive of its institutions. My experience in the last 10 years is that most major corporations and most businessmen who understand the direction of their businesses welcome our input. We're not telling them how to run the company, but we are making some suggestions about specific areas around human rights or the environment or the local communities. I think the movement by the Vatican to go carbon neutral, I think, is a real positive step. In my reading of it, that received a lot of very positive feedback from different corners of the world. That was a very good demonstration of somebody having, I think, a real sensitivity and a real looking at a way, well, here's a way that we could be part of something that so many people around the world are concerned about.
You've been listening to Father Seamus Finn, an oblate of Mary Immaculate and a board member of the International Interfaith Investment Group, speaking to Susie Hodges there. And that brings us up to time. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. Don't forget, we'll be back again at this same time tomorrow. Should you wish to check out our website, our address is www.vaticanradio.org.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.